The question is, why is the American public so willing now to accept things that are patently absurd in their information gathering? And I think that's a bigger question. I don't think you blame the platform for that. I think you have to look at what's underlying those cultural and political values.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. And on this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, my conversation with former U.S. Senator Heidi Heitkamp, a Democrat who represented North Dakota until 2018. She now works on Facebook's political advocacy group known as the American Edge Project, serving on its open and accessible Internet Advisory Board. We talked about why she opposes regulating tech, the tax code, the 2022 midterms, and how President Biden is being received in North Dakota. So explain the argument for your approach to the tech industry. What would you like to see?
Well, I think first off is to establish kind of three pillars or three values. Number one, the importance of this industry to national defense and what that means as we're looking at the kind of challenges, national security challenges we see in the future, whether it's cyber, whether it is in fact making sure that we have the ability to educate and have access to people across the globe in terms of American values. So we've got national security, the economic impact that this industry has had, not only in our country, but globally, and the importance of this industry, not just to the American economy, but to the world economy. And then I'd say the third is how all of these things really reflect American democratic values. And if we basically allow the tech industry to become dominated or advanced in a way that puts people who do, or countries who do not share our democratic values in charge, that we then jeopardize the potential of seeing a growth and certain stability and then growth of liberal democracy across the world.
Haven't we seen that that doesn't work in practice in some key areas of the globe, though?
I think that's the challenge. The challenge is how do you make sure that an open and accessible internet, regardless of who has, who's providing access, provides that kind of content? You know, when I was in the Senate, we did one of the first and I think only probably amendments to the Communication Decency Act, famous 230, and it was for people who knowingly would in fact sell children and traffic children on the internet. It was a very narrowly crafted exception, and it did not breach the kind of overall principles that open and accessible internet and internet that is available to everyone needs to continue to be part of our information infrastructure.
When you say open and accessible, what specifically are you opposed to seeing?
Opposed to seeing?
Yeah.
I think that anything that would in fact put America at a competitive disadvantage, put our companies at a competitive disadvantage, whether it's Google or Facebook or whoever it might be. And, I think it was interesting when you looked at the hearings that the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Antitrust had this last week. What you really saw was people who didn't seem to have a lot of interest in the subject at hand. They were interested in how these tools are being used, or basically, I wouldn't say used, but how these tools result in certain kinds of cyberbullying, certain kinds of results for young girls. I think that there's bigger issues to confront than the issue of competitiveness. When you look at, if you think about Standard Oil, kind of what led to a lot of the 1920s antitrust litigation and legislation, what you were usually doing is looking at a finite commodity that various industries were basically gobbling up and capturing a monopoly. What are really the impediments for someone to be competitive in this space? As long as there is no direct prohibition against competitors entering the marketplace for providing alternatives. I mean, you look at something like Google, the alternative is Bing. It's out there. It comes with most people's Microsoft Office. It's available to people, but yet they use the Google platform and search engine, and they do that free of charge. So I think when you look at kind of the direction a lot of people are taking, the argument is let's break it up because it's big, not let's break it up because it's violated past principles that that were established back in the 20s in terms of not allowing monopolies.
I mean, there are other companies that can compete with sites like Google and Facebook, but practically speaking, they're, you know, if a billion people are using one service, it doesn't matter what the potential for competition is, does it?
Well, I would think so. If you did an analogy that everybody buys Folgers coffee because they like the taste of it and it's available and there's other choices on the shelf, but people reach for Folgers, it doesn't mean that Folgers coffee is now violating some kind of antitrust principle. It means that you have a product that is superior to the other products or a product that people are familiar with and want to continue using.
Isn't the tech industry robust and healthy enough to do what you're suggesting, which is advance innovation and advance, you know, U.S. interests in a way, but also meet regulatory strictures?
Well, explain to me what those regulatory strictures might be.
Well,
and I think that's the question. Everybody's saying, well, they're big, therefore they're bad. And I think it's important, number one, to understand where the public is on this issue, which is really not engaged at all, if our polling is to be believed. And number one, what is the injury to the marketplace and to new entrants coming in?
Well, let's talk about Facebook specifically. You know, you're talking about a platform that, you know, a billion people are using around the globe, where misinformation has just spread much faster than real information. And that's had very extreme consequences for, you know, things like elections and, you know, COVID information and so on.
So I think that then you have to ask the question, who becomes the policeman for misinformation? Is it the platform itself, who then decides what's going to be put on the website and what isn't going to be put on the website? Or is it the people who use the platform? You know, when I talk about misinformation, and we spend a lot of time in various forums talking about this, whether it is, you know, being a fellow at universities or talking about kind of the future of politics, what I say simply is that we need a more resilient populace. They need to have better critical thinking skills, because there's always going to be somebody out there who's going to find a way to get a message that is contrary to the truth. Yeah, when I started in politics, you didn't have Facebook, but yet you had these string emails that everybody would get, they would read. And I made it a routine practice to fact check them and send back up the chain the real information. The question is, why is the American public so willing now to accept things that are patently absurd in their information gathering? And I think that's a bigger question. I don't think you blame the platform for that. I think you have to look at what's underlying those cultural and political values that now everybody now has become engaged in confirmation bias as opposed to critical thinking and analysis. And so if you simply blame the platform, whether it's Fox News or whether it's Facebook or, you know, the New York Times or MSNBC, you miss the real point, which is that we have become a society that is incredibly susceptible to misinformation and misinformation that is clearly provable as wrong.
But I guess
so. It's not just conspiracy theories. It's a lot of scientific data that people no longer are willing to accept the opinion of experts. The opinion of their neighbor is more important.
But I guess if you're talking about, you know, 30, 40 years ago, if somebody had a conspiracy theory that they, wanted to spread, and it was their First Amendment right to do so. You know, they'd go to the library, make copies, send them through the mail to a number of people who might be interested. I mean, the speed of the thing has really gained momentum with the new technology. Yeah. And for a platform like Facebook, I mean, it's been documented that misinformation just does spread faster on that platform than real information, and algorithms have supported the spread of that misinformation. And Facebook, in many documented cases, has just been too slow to label things as inaccurate or take them down.
Well, I think that's an enforcement problem of their own guidelines and rules. The question is whether government should get involved in requiring a censorship of information that then allows anyone with a political bias to censor information one way or the other. We need to remember that Facebook not only are the people who are on the more progressive end of political thought upset by Facebook, but people on the very right-wing side of the progressive thought or of the political thought are also upset by Facebook. And what Facebook is trying to do, and I think most platforms are trying to do, is maintain the openness of the internet, the openness of the free flow of information, but also be mindful of the challenges that you have when a lie can go around the world seven times before the truth catches up. And that's why I'm saying the better thing may not be to take it down, but to make sure that we have a resilient population that then can engage in the dialogue in the space that they're in. If you think about the kinds of people who would be persuaded by that information, there's probably 10 to 15% of the people, wouldn't matter what form they got it in, they would believe it.
That might be low, honestly.
Well, I think it might be, but boy, I mean, it's just discouraging to think that's 30%, which is one of the numbers that I've seen. But the question becomes, where are the rest of us in engaging? We have become so siloed in who we talk to, so siloed in what we read and what we analyze, that we failed to really kind of engage broadly in this dialogue. And when people are left to their own devices, in politics, we used to say, you want to get on top of an untruth, because if you don't, it'll be perceived to be the truth if you don't respond. So things that are not responded to get so much more traction than things that are immediately responded to. And so, you know, you fight misinformation with the right information, and you figure out how to get there. And you be very, very wary of government interaction in controlling platforms and controlling what platforms can put on their website what people share on websites that are open access to the public.
Let me follow up on that then, because we did get to see this played out almost to the nth degree in January of 2021. Mm-hmm. Facebook and Twitter decided that then President Trump had to be removed from their platforms because of the January 6th riot at the Capitol. And that was not government saying, we've got to, you know, for public safety, we've got to take these posts down. That was the platforms taking the posts down. So if I'm understanding your argument correctly, to you, that's an acceptable outcome.
Yep, it is. Because number one, it's a private entity that the results were so extreme and were played out in real time. And just as I said, when I looked at my role in amending 230, when it involved Backpage basically being complicit in advertising young girls, minors, as escorts and as prostitutes, that's an extreme situation. And I think government regulation belonged there. I think that it's like anything else when you deal with the First Amendment or you deal with platforms that allow for free expression, you have to be very narrow and you have to be very strategic about when you do them. And it has to be the equivalent of shouting fire in a crowded theater.
Did they let Donald Trump exist for too long, though? I mean, he was saying things that were patently untrue for many, many years.
Well, yeah. And how did he start? He started by what I call the entertainment factor of politics. He was good ratings for CNN, He was good ratings for MSNBC. He was good ratings for Fox News. And he had, from there, and from, I suppose, a television show, but I think really believe that from the early stages of the primary season, with nonstop coverage of Donald Trump as kind of the entertainment value of politics, he basically gained a foothold and a almost cult-like following in America. And that was the beginning of it. And so that didn't have anything to do with Facebook, in my opinion. Didn't have anything to do with Google. Didn't have anything to do with Twitter. It had to do with what people, when they turned on news services and watched what they were seeing every day, and people who said, look, you know, he is saying things that I have not been allowed to say. He is saying things that I've thought in my heart, but, you know, didn't think I could say in polite company. He now has given me permission. And I always say he did not create the Proud Boys. He did not create the Oath Keepers. He did not create these right wing, hopefully fringe American political groups, but he emboldened them and he gave them permission to exist. And that started not with a platform, that started with television.
I know I'm coming around to this for the last time, but isn't it up to the platform? If the platform isn't, making it more difficult for people like the Proud Boys to share their message, doesn't government have a role in saying this is just beyond the bounds of what's acceptable for the public to be seeing?
Well, and what I would say is, isn't it up to the platform to... Here's a great example. Yeah, I can't tell you how many times as a former United States senator, people tell me that I have my salary as a United States senator for life and I get free health insurance. None of that's true. It's never been true. And it is the kind of myth that is perpetuated on every platform, including email chains. And so how you fight that is not by saying, well, no, that's not true, so you need to shut that down. You fight it by providing real information. And maybe what we should be doing is spending more time kind of realizing where people are and where they're getting their information and making sure that we are basically providing the correct information or at least a counterpoint. You know, I talk about this in rural America. We used to have things like coffee tables. And, you know, in North Dakota, there weren't a lot of Democrats, but they went to the coffee table at 10 o'clock or in the morning in the early mornings for breakfast. And they debated the issues and there would be an honest debate. Somebody would say something and say, that's not true. That didn't happen that way. I read this in the Fargo form. You know, that's not what this was. And then everybody sitting around the table, you may not have been able to persuade the person who was arguing the counterpoint, but everybody around the table got both sides of the issue. Now we have confirmation bias where everybody goes out and only looks at what they want to confirm what they believe. And there has got to be a way that we can, in fact, provide more information. Mark Melman, who is a pollster, Democratic pollster, wrote an article recently talking about how various people with different political ideas see experts. And basically the conclusion was that the Republicans that were polled, certainly in his poll, did not respect expertise. And you're seeing this play out in the pandemic where doctors over and over again say these things are safe. They will save lives. They will save your family's lives. But people don't want to believe it. And even when they're presented with an overwhelming facts, they don't want to believe it because they've got confirmation bias. And it's about, I'm now an expert. We've got to get back to a meaningful, consistent public dialogue on misinformation. And it can't be, I mean, that the quick answer that everybody wants is let's regulate the internet or let's control this or control that. Once you control it for what you think is information, it could be easily controlled for misinformation. And so the hard fact truth is that the hard truth is that if you want to stop misinformation, you have to fight it with real information and you have to keep an internet open to do that.
Do you think Senator Joe Manchin will be a yes on this $3.5 trillion Biden package at the end of the day?
No. I think that package will be pared down. And the question is one thing I will tell you about Joe, and Joe is one of my best friends from the Senate, is that he has said repeatedly, I will not accept $3.5 trillion. I won't accept that package. People keep saying, well, what will it take to get you to yes? And he keeps saying the same thing back. The answer is no. So give me another proposal. And I think what's going to happen here will be another proposal.
Do you have a number in mind?
No, I don't have a number. I'm not there. I am a big believer that the two issues that we desperately need to solve if we are going to get our economy healthy and vibrant again is childcare and housing. And so if I were there, I would be looking at those two pillars as essential for economic growth, feeling like if we made an investment there, we would see economic growth for the middle class, which would result in greater tax revenue, but also result in greater economic opportunity for American citizens. You know, the one thing that I think kind of escapes everybody's discussion is a fundamental truth about the difference between Democrats and Republicans. Republicans always like investing in things, bridges, buildings, whatever. I mean, you know, anything that puts a nail in a board or a brick on a wall, that they're all for that. Democrats believe that the true wealth in America is created by human beings, and we have to invest in human beings if we're going to continue America's economic prosperity. And so when people say this infrastructure package is phony because it's not infrastructure, it is exactly the kind of infrastructure that Democrats need to invest in, which is human capital. And so the question is, what are the priorities within that ranking, and how do you pay for them? And so I think what Joe is saying is 3.5 is too rich for my blood, but I'm not opposed, and I know he's not opposed, to investing in human capital.
So lastly, then, Democrats, especially on the left of your party, they've been saying that the tax reform proposal that the House Democrats outlined a couple of weeks ago would reinstate higher rates for high earners and corporations didn't go far enough in taxing the uber wealthy. And in a recent interview, you said that taxing the uber wealthy would be bad politically in the long run for Democrats. Can you explain that?
That is not what I said.
What did you say?
You know, what I said was taxing unrealized capital gains is inconsistent with our tax code, and it is incredibly unpopular in America. There are other ways to basically deal with wealth and tax disparity. And so you take capital gains. I have long been an advocate of equalizing the capital gains rate to the earned income tax rate. So there's tax that is on unearned income, which would be capital gains, dividends, interest, things where your money makes money for you. And then there's tax that you get from your labor, you know, your W-2 income or your 1099 income. We have had over the years a growing disparity in the rates between capital gains, money you make on your money, and money you make on your labor. That is wrong as a fundamental principle, in my opinion, of economics and taxation. Why should money that we make on money be taxed at a lower rate than money we make if we go to work at the Bobcat factory? I also have said we need step-up basis reform. What is particularly injurious to the political fortunes, especially in places that I've been trying to grow the Democratic Party base, is taxing unrealized capital gains. You know, and so when people get into this kind of spin on, oh, you want to keep the tax breaks for the uber wealthy, it again, going back to misinformation, that's misinformation, and it speaks to the unwillingness that a lot of people have to really try and understand the tax code.
But the average person at the Bobcat factory isn't coming in line for a ton of money on capital gains at death, most likely.
How do you know that? How do you know that? I mean, the example that I gave that other people tried to pick apart, but it was based on Joe Biden's example. A single person, here you go, a single person whose folks have owned a cabin on a lake in Minnesota, right? That since that other people have built million-dollar houses around, he simply wants to go there and go fishing, bring his kids out to go, you know, water skiing or tubing. He now inherits from his folks. That property probably has capital gains of over $1 million on it. He didn't want to sell it. But if you tax him at death of his parents, you're going to have to sell it because he can't afford the 40%. I got an email from a businessman who said, I worked hard my whole life, never made $1 million in my life, never made $1 million. He said, but I recently sold my business and I'm going to have capital gains of $1 million. And 40% of that's going to go, of what I've saved for my retirement in my business is going to go away. And so there are real examples out there that will lead the political dialogue, and taxing at death is always been problematic in the heartland and will continue to be problematic. And polls will tell you even Democrats don't want to tax people unless people have actually sold something. And that has been my discussion and my point of view. And, you know, I think it's interesting the focus on my point of view. Number one, I'm a former tax commissioner, so I've spent a lot of time dealing with this. I've also spent a lot of time doing things that have not been popular for multinational corporations, such as using worldwide unitary taxation in North Dakota, which is a long story. You don't need to know about it. And so this idea that somehow I have changed my political or my tax philosophy is completely wrong. I've never thought we should tax unrealized capital gains.
Is there a way for Democrats to fund this package and increase, the taxes that the very wealthy pay while retaining what you're looking for, which is the capital gains at death not affecting the average taxpayer? Is there a way to do all three?
Number one, I don't think you should ever tax capital gains at death without them being realized. So, you know, I think there's this
doesn't matter the
about exceptions.
The amount of money there. I get it.
Yeah. So, but understand this, and it's a bit of irony. When George Bush did estate tax reform, he, in his reform, adopted something called carry forward basis. Okay, not stepped up basis, but carry forward basis. What that meant is you would inherit at the basis that whoever gave it to you, parents or whatever, held it. So if you had farmland at $10 an acre, you inherited at $1,000, you wouldn't have to pay the tax when you inherited it, but your basis, if you did sell that property, would be $10. And it was Joe Biden that led the negotiations that eliminated that because they were more interested in doing estate tax reform. And so this is estate tax and basis adjustment are two sides of the same coin. And so, you know, understand that there have in the past, I mean, as late as the 1980s, there have been proposals, or excuse me, the 2000s, there have been proposals. And in fact, it was the law and stepped up basis was getting phased out for carry forward basis. And that was reformed in a compromise with the Republicans led by then Vice President Joe Biden. So, you know, everybody's kind of forgetting a little history here, too.
Last question. How are people in places like North Dakota, people you're speaking with, thinking about President Biden's performance so far?
Well, I mean, I think you can look at the numbers. And if the polls are to be believed, there was a lot of people in rural America interested in giving him a chance. I think he had a great start with the stimulus package after COVID. You know, some of the kind of things that people saw government stabilizing and not being so chaotic. That was all very favorable and very positive. I think that now as time has gone on and as the pandemic has resurged, I think it's become more difficult. And the numbers, as you can see them, are not the favorability numbers are not what they were in the early days of the presidency. And in fact, are not other than I think Donald Trump are worse than any recent modern president. So and those are being driven by independents. Which are essential if you're going to be politically successful as a Democrat in my neck of the woods. But they're also being driven by a reduction of support among Democrats and certainly a solidifying of anti-Biden sentiment among Republicans. Is it too late? No. I mean, if I could wave a magic wand, I would say vote on the infrastructure package today. get something done that's bipartisan. Tell people you can govern working together. Deal with the issues at the border. Everybody knows that they're difficult. No one wants to see children in cages. No one wants to see people run down by horses. If you do, you are somebody who is on the fringe of American values, in my opinion. And so deal with the issues that you can deal with. And be bold when you've solidified support. And I think there's a lot of people who are in this hurry up because we're going to lose in the midterms. And my argument would be, why don't you figure out how to win in the midterms so that you can continue to govern beyond 2 years? And the real lesson is, whatever you do in 2 years when things flip can be undone in the next 2 years. We need stability in government to basically reestablish America's trust in government. And I think the lack of trust in government is being played out, whether it's people refusing to get vaccinations or whether it is, harsh language and debate that goes on the internet that's not particularly helpful.
Heidi Heitkamp is a Democrat, a former U.S. Senator from North Dakota. Really appreciate all your time. Thank you for having this conversation with us.
You bet.
All right, that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Ian Pickus.